The committee formed to produce a compromise on the poisonous issue of slavery did its work swiftly enough. Appointed on August 22nd, it was ready with a report at the opening of Friday's session of August 24th. Despite the high words spoken on the floor of the convention, the climate of the committee meeting itself was substantially cooler. Notwithstanding their aversion to slavery, recalled Luther Martin, sitting as one of the committee's members, the delegates from the northern states who had spoken so fiercely against slavery proved very willing to indulge the southern states, rather than, as Edmund Randolph put it, risk the Constitution, especially if the southern delegates were willing to allow the federal government to tax slave imports. So, after a very little time, the committee, by a very great majority, agreed on a report by which the general government was to be prohibited from preventing the importation of slaves for a limited time. The limited time was only to last until 1800, a not entirely generous 13 years. So when the committee report came up for a vote on Saturday, August 25th, Charles Coatsworth Pinckney was once again ready with an objection and demanded that the limited time for slave importation be extended to 1808, a full 20 years. This provoked James Madison, who had been biting his tongue all through the slavery discussions. On the one hand, the Madisons of Montpelier were themselves the owners of 118 slaves. And Madison had been accompanied as an undergraduate at Princeton by a slave named Sawney, and arrived in Philadelphia in 1783 for the Confederation Congress with a slave named Billy in tow. But as much as Madison relied on enslaved black labor, he also loathed it as an institution. Earlier in the convention, he'd remarked in passing that the mere distinction of color has been made in the most enlightened period of time a ground of the most oppressive dominion ever exercised by man over man. 2 years before, he had written to Edmund Randolph that he hoped to depend as little as possible on the labor of slaves. Now, Pinckney's amendment brought Madison to his feet. 20 more years of the slave trade? 20 years, he said, will produce all the mischief that can be apprehended from the liberty to import slaves. So long a term will be more dishonorable to the national character than to say nothing about it in the Constitution. It did no good. Pinckney's amendment passed by a vote of 7-4, although at least Madison's own Virginia delegation voted against it. The amendment did not disturb the committee's tiptoe care in wrapping its reference to the slave trade in a euphemism, the migration or importation of such persons as the several states now existing shall think proper to admit. And Gouverneur Morris savagely proposed that the convention drop all pretense to embarrassment over slavery and simply rewrite the entire clause to call it the importation of slaves. The South Carolina delegation was not finished. On August 29th, Pierce Butler moved yet another amendment, making the extradition of fugitive slaves a matter of federal responsibility, which, in effect, forced the northern states into legal cooperation with southern slaveholders in hunting down runaway slaves. This time, no one even bothered to object. And Charles Coatsworth Pinckney would be able to spin this in 1788 to his South Carolina constituents, announcing that we have secured an unlimited importation of Negroes for 20 years, nor is it declared that the importation shall be then stopped. It may be continued. We have a security that the general government can never emancipate them, for no such authority is granted, and we have obtained a right to recover our slaves in whatever part of America they may take refuge, which is a right we had not before. It was a devil's bargain, and Madison knew it. The South Carolinians had held the entire Constitution hostage, and they meant it. Great as the evil is, Madison sighed, a dismemberment of the Union would be worse. And he would not have put it past South Carolina to disunite from the other states and solicit and obtain aid from foreign powers. The fact that one single objection to the Committee of Detail's work had almost derailed the entire convention was not a good sign. It is easy to become weary in doing good. And with the end of August looming and no conclusion to the wrangling over the Committee of Detail in sight, John Rutledge began complaining about the length of the session, the probable impatience of the public, and the extreme anxiety of many members of the convention to bring the business to an end. Madison was growing fearful that the convention might be spun out for months. And Washington archly remarked on August 19th that one thing the convention could never be faulted for in future was any hurry with which the business has been conducted. It is also easy, though, to lose sight of how great a service the Committee of Detail performed. The 23 articles which the Committee of Detail drafted and presented on August 6th contained almost all of the Constitution as we know it today. The committee established new terminology: President for the single executive, Senate and House of Representatives for the new national legislature, and enumerated the limits of federal power, with the saving proviso that the new federal Congress would retain authority to make all laws that shall be necessary and proper to enforce those powers. But by August 27th, the convention still had not finished its deliberations over 12 of the Committee of Detail's 23 articles. And it was clearly time to find some way of accelerating, which it did, by once again employing the tactic which had worked so well in breaking up log jams before. On August 31st, on a motion from Roger Sherman, the 12 articles, which had failed to generate a consensus thus far, were referred to a Committee on Postponed Parts to deal with such parts of the Constitution as have been postponed, with 11 members on the committee that included Madison, John Dickinson, Gouverneur Morris, and Sherman himself. This was the fourth committee the convention had created after the Grand Committee in June on Representation, John Rutledge's Committee of Detail, and the Committee on Slavery. And at first, this committee's prospects did not look encouraging, largely because the convention handed the chairmanship to William Patterson's friend, David Brearley. A lawyer, like so many others in the convention, Brearley was born in Spring Grove, New Jersey, went to Princeton, but did not graduate, and threw himself wholeheartedly into the revolutionary cause. He served as a lieutenant colonel in the Continental Army, following Washington through all of the Army's campaigns from Long Island in 1776 to Valley Forge in the winter of 1777 to 78. The next year, he was named Chief Justice of the New Jersey Supreme Court and attached himself politically to William Patterson, the architect of that one state, one vote New Jersey plan. Brearley inspired respect, but not enthusiasm, much less loyalty. William Pierce described him as a man of good rather than of brilliant parts. As an orator, he has little to boast of. And in fact, Brearley opened his mouth only a dozen times in the convention. But, added Pierce, in an effort to say something pleasant, as a man, he has every virtue to recommend him. Which means what, exactly? Others were more blunt. Although hardly a brilliant figure, Brearley was capable and respected. He owned neither land nor investments, and was not the man to carry the New Jersey plan forward on his own. After Patterson quit the convention in disgust in July, Brearley begged him to return and assist him, but Patterson snorted that the convention was full of disputation and noisy as the wind. He would not be going down again to Philadelphia. Despite having the colorless David Brearley in charge, in many respects, the Committee on Postponed Parts turned out to be the most effective committee the convention created. Its principal business was to reconcile the competing demands about the shape of the new national president, and they did so in unusually direct ways. First of all, the committee toyed once more with the idea of having the new Congress elect the president, just as the old Confederation Congress had done. That was dismissed energetically by John Dickinson, who reminded the Committee on Postponed Parts that the powers which we have agreed to vest in the president were so many and great that the office would lack all legitimacy, unless it could be filled by popular vote. As Dickinson recalled, Madison then took out a pen and paper and sketched out a mode of electing the president, which turned out to be James Wilson's original proposal for a college of electors of the president, chosen by those of the people in each state who shall have the qualifications requisite. This would dampen the objections made by George Mason to direct election by the common rabble, and yet still preserving the idea that the president should entirely owe his elevation to the will of the people directly declared through their organs, the electors, so that the president would have a broad and solid base for him to stand upon. The Committee on Postponed Parts also ironed out the thorny issues of the qualifications for office, the term of office, and the foreign and domestic powers the president should exercise. A president must be a natural-born citizen, will hold his office during the term of 4 years, shall have power to make treaties, and, with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors and other public ministers, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States. And the committee also added provisions in other places, which required the states to grant full faith and credit to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state, granted to Congress the power to raise and support armies, called for the creation of a federal district not exceeding 10 miles square to become the seat of the government of the United States, and to secure copyright protection to authors and inventors in order to promote the progress of science and useful arts, and to make historical writers like myself happy. And actually, it all worked. The Committee on Postponed Parts made its report over several days, from September 1st to the 5th, and after a flurry of proposed amendments, Roger Sherman navigated the committee's report, piece by piece, to approval by September 8th. And as if to make it clear that the convention wanted no more shilly-shallying around, a fifth and last committee, the Committee on Style, was formed on the 8th, comprising Madison, Gouverneur Morris, Alexander Hamilton, who had only just returned to Philadelphia 3 days before, Rufus King, and William Samuel Johnson of Connecticut, to revise the style of and arrange the articles which had been agreed to by the House. It was a clear signal that the convention wanted its work to be finished and the final polishing applied. Strictly speaking, the sole task of the Committee on Style was that of wordsmithing everything. Every report, every amendment which had been agreed to in the convention into a single, smoothly flowing document. But neither Madison nor Morris could quite let go of one last opportunity to set the direction of the Constitution pointing in the ways they had always favored. Morris, in particular, had the itch as well as the talent to make words work. He would, years later, actually claim that the Constitution was written by the fingers which write this letter. And he showed that on the very threshold of the Constitution by writing the states out of the Committee of Detail's preamble entirely. The preamble now read, as Madison and Morris had both wanted it to be, as the action not of the states, but of the American people as a whole, and for the broadest and most generous purposes imaginable. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Morris's capacity for sharp, plain language showed up not only in the rewriting of the preamble, but also in the words he used to preface the article on the executive branch, over which the Committee on Postponed Parts had labored so intensely. Morris reshaped it simply to read, "The executive power shall be vested in a President of the United States of America." And as if to give the Pattersonites one final twist of the dagger, Morris inserted the declaration that this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And not only the Constitution, but even the private contracts of individuals would trump state laws and state legislatures. Since states may not pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts. Above all, the Committee on Style worked fast. In 4 days, Morris took the 23 articles of the Committee of Detail's report and worked them down to just 7, dealing out one article each to the presidency, the national legislature, and the judiciary. Another article regulated the interaction of federal and state governments. A fifth described a process for amending the Constitution. And the sixth dealt with 3 separated issues on national indebtedness, forbidding any religious test as a qualification for public office, and the federal supremacy clause that Morris was so proud of. The last article, in only 23 words, simply stated that ratification of the conventions of 9 states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this Constitution between the states so ratifying the same. The simplicity with which the ratification process was described made it easy to miss how Morris had made ratification the job not of state legislatures or even the Confederation Congress, but of special purpose state conventions. We the people, indeed. On September 12th, Committee Chair William Samuel Johnson had the full text of the new document ready for distribution in the convention as a printed broadside. The convention sensed that the summit of the mountain was near. On September 6th, Madison eagerly wrote to Thomas Jefferson, promising that the term of the convention's dissolution cannot be more than 1 or 2 weeks distant. At the close of the session on Monday, September 10th, Charles Pinckney proposed that the Committee on Style be charged with preparing an address to the people to be laid with the same before the United States in Congress, a gesture which would have been needless if the convention anticipated prolonged debate over the Committee on Style's other work. And yet, even at this last hour, there were surprises, the first of which came from Elbridge Gerry, who in his usual eccentric manner now decided to make an issue of one of the smaller provisions of the Committee of Detail, the one which delegated to Congress the power to make war, to raise armies, to build and equip fleets. Gerry had already put himself on record in mid-August opposing standing armies in time of peace. Since the Constitution, as written, put no limit on the size of the armies that Congress could recruit, Gary could only imagine Congress using this phrase as an excuse for creating an enormous, permanent army to terrify the people. And therefore, he said, he could never consent to a power to keep up an indefinite number. Maybe, he allowed, Congress could be permitted to maintain an army of 1,000, perhaps even 2,000 or 3,000, but not more. A remark which led George Washington to mutter sarcastically that in that case, the Constitution should limit any potential invaders of the United States to the same number. On September 5th, Gary was back at the attack, this time complaining that this power might be made use of to enslave any particular state, and at least would be a means of awing the state into an undue obedience to the general government. On the last day of debate, September 15th, Gary once again was at work, querulously denying Congress's authority to raise armies and money without limit. And in a grand gesture of defiance, Gary promised to withhold his name from the Constitution. Gary found a surprisingly sympathetic spirit in George Mason, who had come to the convention in May, fully prepared to endorse a replacement of the Articles of Confederation, but who had been gradually hemorrhaging enthusiasm for the new Constitution as the weeks dragged by. 3 months before, Mason was convinced that the present Confederation was not only deficient in not providing for coercion and punishment against delinquent states, but argued very cogently that punishment could not be in the nature of things executed on the states collectively, and therefore such a government was necessary as could operate directly on individuals. But Mason was uneasy over the creation of a single national president and over the powers awarded to the Senate, and he was genuinely alarmed at the 20-year allowance granted to slave imports. By the time the Committee on Style submitted its draft of the Constitution to the convention on September 12th, Mason had convinced himself that the real threat was posed not by too feeble a government, but by a too powerful government. And at that point, he took the floor to ask that the Constitution be prefaced with a Bill of Rights. This would give great quiet to the people, and with the aid of the state declarations, a bill might be prepared in a few hours. This was not an empty promise, since Mason had himself drafted the Virginia Declaration of Rights in 1776. Nor were bills of rights a novelty. The ancestor of all bills of rights in Anglo-American law is the Magna Carta of 1215, followed by the Petition of Right, adopted by Parliament in 1628, Oliver Cromwell's Instrument of Government in 1653, and the Parliamentary Bill of Rights in 1689. All of them have in common a determination to set limits around the power of government, and to spell out a number of basic civil privileges which cannot be compromised or tampered with. By itself, no one who had endured the storm of the American Revolution would have any resistance to a Bill of Rights, but Madison was incredulous at Mason's motion. First, because the Constitution was a document which did little else than set limits around the power of government, thus obviating any need for a Bill of Rights. Second, because the Constitution in fact contained a number of specific protections for rights, the ban on religious tests, for instance, or on bills of attainder. And third, because Mason, by insisting on the need for a Bill of Rights, was suggesting that the new Constitution was in fact endangering the rights all the previous Bills of Rights had been created to protect. That, Madison perceived, as a subtle attempt at sabotage, especially when the Constitution was submitted for ratification to the states' conventions. And Washington, however much affection he had for Mason, agreed. To alarm the people seems to be the groundwork of his plan. But more alarming still was the dissent which came from the man who had introduced the first plan of the Constitution back at the end of May, and that was Edmund Randolph. Like Mason, Randolph had grown more and more uneasy over the powers being ceded to the new national government. As early as June 1st, he had warned against a single executive as the fetus of monarchy. The fixed genius of the people of America required a different form of government than some elective monarch, Randolph protested. By September, he was no happier with the finished Constitution. And on September 10th, he warned that if no change should be made in this part of the plan, he should be obliged to dissent from the whole of it. He had come to the convention with a set of Republican propositions as the basis and outline of a reform of the Articles of Confederation. But these Republican propositions, he said, had been widely and, in his opinion, irreconcilably departed from. His best hope was that the state ratifying conventions would instead offer amendments to the plan, and that these amendments should be incorporated into a second constitution drafted by a second constitutional convention. When this warning was ignored, Randolph repeated it on September 15th and added that should this proposition be disregarded, it would be impossible for him to put his name to the instrument. Mason joined him, glumly prophesying that the dangerous power and structure of the new national government would end either in monarchy or a tyrannical aristocracy. And Mason, too, called for a second constitutional convention. Gary, of course, followed suit, listing 8 separate objections which determined him to withhold his name from the Constitution. But to Madison's boundless relief, the convention now turned a deaf ear to Randolph's, Mason's, and Gary's complaints. The motion to provide for a second convention was unanimously voted down. On the question to agree to the Constitution as amended, every state delegation voted aye. The convention adjourned and went to dinner at 6 o'clock at City Tavern. The next day, September 16th, was the day for Jacob Shallus, a revolutionary veteran and the assistant clerk of the Pennsylvania legislature, to prepare a formal, engrossed copy of the Constitution, executed with goose quill pens and iron-based ink, and consuming 4 pages of parchment. The convention assembled for the official signing ceremony on Monday, September 17th. The convention's secretary, William Jackson, read the engrossed copy aloud. But before the delegates could be summoned to sign, tottering Benjamin Franklin begged leave to speak. Actually, he was too tottering even to speak, so he handed the written version of his speech to James Wilson to read aloud. I confess that there are several parts of this Constitution which I do not at present approve. That was what Wilson read. Nevertheless, the document went on, I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such. And why? No Constitution ever corrupted a people who weren't already corrupt. And there is no form of government but what may be a blessing to the people if well administered. If he believed there were errors in the Constitution, Franklin sacrificed those reservations to the public good, and he hoped all of his fellow delegates would do likewise in recommending this Constitution wherever our influence may extend and turn our future thoughts and endeavors to the means of having it well administered. A few others made little speeches before the 39 delegates trooped up to sign the Constitution, including Gary, Mason, and Randolph, explaining once again why they were refusing to sign. But the last word belonged to Franklin. who, looking towards the president's chair, at the back of which a rising sun happened to be painted, observed to a few members near him that painters had found it difficult to distinguish in their art a rising from a setting sun. "I have," said he, "often and often in the course of the session, and the vicissitudes of my hopes and fears as to its issue, looked at that behind the president without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now, at length, I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun." Now, it was time to go home.